Welcome back to the program. As fate would have it, I just came back from two very intense days in Silicon Valley, learning of the ways that digital technology is changing radio, entertainment, and connected technology, mostly in our cars. Imagine a car that, when the check engine light comes on, diagnoses the problem, contacts the appropriate repair facility, and makes the first available appointment for you, all without you having to do anything. Effortless, frictionless, and in many ways antithetical to the human need to have some control over our environment. There is no question that the geeks and entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley want to change the world, that they want digital solutions to the world's problems. The problem is that they want to define the problems, and in that way we may be trying to transform human nature in ways that may not be in our long-term best interests. These are some of the ideas put forth by my guest, Evgeny Morozov. He's the author of the best-selling The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom. He's a contributing editor to The New Republic, and it is my pleasure to welcome Evgeny Morozov to the program today to talk about his newest work, To Save Everything, Click Here. Evgeny Morozov, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, sure. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. Talk a little bit first about how, in many ways, these ideas that you put forth are kind of a continuation of some of the things you talked about in Net Delusion.
So my first book, The Net Delusion, was about a general sense of excitement that I think invaded a lot of offices in Washington, particularly offices of policymakers and the State Department, with regards to what social media and Twitter and Facebook could do in authoritarian states. So there was a lot of excitement. When I first started writing this book, and it was still 2007, 2008, about social media being able to topple dictators, and then, you know, social movements forming online and toppling and then staying in power. And, you know, some of that played out in the Arab Spring, but, you know, as we see now, of course, many of these movements that got formed could not be very effective against more established groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, which did not rely on the internet but had a very good political structure. So I try to understand the limitations of social media and the internet as solutions to the problem of promoting democracy in my first book. With my second book that just came out this week, I try to go one step further and try to understand some of the other temptations, if you will, to solve problems, but in our own backyard, in liberal democracies, problems that have to do with our own political system, problems that have to do with a lot of the big issues we face, whether it's climate change, whether it's obesity. Technology increasingly plays and will play a huge role in solving them, in part because all of us are carrying mobile phones, all of us will soon be carrying Google Glasses, and it becomes possible to intervene in what we do and tell us that we should be recycling more, we should be exercising more, we should be eating less, right? All of those interventions suddenly become possible as we are perpetually online and we are perpetually carrying gadgets and devices that are capable of providing feedback. So what I do in this book is try to investigate just how far we should allow Silicon Valley, which manufactures all of these devices, to take charge of problem solving, and what are some of the pitfalls associated with delegating so much responsibility to techies and geeks who may not fully appreciate the complexity of the human condition that they're trying to engineer.
And of course, part of it is that in trying to solve any problem, a great deal of it, as you talk about, depends on how we define the problem. Because before we can come up with a solution, we have to define it. And the way problems are being defined today in terms of creating no friction, no opacity, no need to remember anything are not necessarily things that are consistent with human nature.
A very disturbing trend that I've noticed is that increasingly problems are defined as problems based solely on the fact that we have a nice and shiny digital solution to them, right? So we have the means to record and store and remember everything, and the very fact that we have the tools makes us think that forgetting is a genuine problem that needs to be eliminated. You know, the same can be said about hypocrisy in politics, for example, or inconsistency in your own personal life. A lot of geeks think that if if you can have a gadget that will monitor everything you do and everything you say and how much time you spend with your children, and if it will hit you with the statistics every evening or every Sunday at the end of the week, you will become a more coherent, consistent, truthful person. And I just think that such a reductionist view of human nature that doesn't provide us with some spaces to be incoherent and to be inconsistent, it's not a very rich conception of human nature that will eventually impoverish us, and that if you actually don't start to solve this problem by focusing on the tools, and you start solving it focusing on philosophy, and you start asking yourself, well, just how much forgetting do we want to preserve? Just how much consistency or inconsistency we want to have in our lives? Just how much ambiguity and inconsistency and hypocrisy we want to live in our political system? You will not arrive at the answers that the gigs arrive at, right? In part because their primary interest is marketing their own tools and marketing their own technologies. So of course they have a bias, and of course they want to solve all of the problems with their own technologies, but it doesn't mean that what they see as problems should count as problems. And that's the key idea introduced with the term solutionism, which to me does define this tendency to find solutions to problems without ever examining whether the issue at hand actually counts as a problem in the first place.
Beyond the need to market shiny gadgets, there is also the sense that these people are really making the world better. They believe that. They believe that the flatter the world they create, the better it's going to be.
Of course they do, and I think there are several explanations as to why that happens. I mean, there is clearly an explanation that tries to appeal to the general public and convince us that that we'll need to make sacrifices in order to improve the world, right? That perhaps by disclosing more information about us and having Google and Facebook store it, we may not like it because it will undermine our privacy, but it might be good for the world because it will help solve the problem of cancer, right? If we all start uploading our health information online, right? It might help solve many other problems if only we are prepared to make sacrifices, right? So there is a very interesting rhetorical move here on behalf of Silicon Valley, and it's basically saying that what they do might seem offensive to some of us, but it should be okay because essentially they're making the world a better place. And of course, then there is another explanation that I think is also worth examining, and it's that a lot of Silicon Valley companies compete for the same talent pool as Wall Street. They are going after the same quants, after the same engineers, after the same computer scientists. And of course, Wall Street, working against the background of the financial crisis, just does not have the same powerful story of changing the world as Silicon Valley, right? You cannot join a Wall Street bank and think that you're solving poverty in Africa, right? No one has that illusion. That's why they have to be paid so much. In Silicon Valley, you can still have that illusion and tell people that by joining Google or by joining Facebook, you will be solving problems like climate change or obesity or knowledge, lack of knowledge in Africa or poverty in Africa and many others. And of course, that works great, just a human resource management tool. So, you know, this is something, and, you know, there are many other background assumptions here. Of course, we treat information different from, say, money, right? Ever since the time of Enlightenment, any company or institution that is in the knowledge business is treated more respectfully than a company that drills oil, right? In part because we think that information leads to knowledge, knowledge leads to truth, truth leads to science, and this is what underpins human progress, right? So companies that are in the business of organizing some of the world's knowledge, all of the world's knowledge, which is what Google wants to do, do tend to get treated differently than companies that are just pumping oil or making widgets.
There is the sense that there is not only the bias that technology is always good, but the forgetting sometimes that hierarchies are sometimes good, that inefficiency is sometimes good, that not everything has to be virtuous 100% of the time. And those are the things that get teased out.
Yes, and I think, you know, imperfection is something that we need to rediscover and we need to understand it philosophically. I mean, look at how our world functioned up until very recently. A lot of things were imperfect by design, right? You could not monitor everything you were doing simply because technology did not provide for that. You could not monitor every single thing said by politicians over the course of their careers because there was simply no way to monitor and store it, right? There was no way for someone to intervene into what you order at a restaurant because your glasses were dumb, right? Your glasses did not have the capacity to actually recognize objects in your visual field. Now that also becomes possible. So as we have the means to get rid of imperfections, it becomes very tempting to just assume that imperfections are always bad and that, you know, eliminating them is always virtuous. And I think that, you know, we need to think harder. We need to try harder. And we need to understand that even though some of those imperfections were by design, there were also good philosophical reasons for those imperfections to be in place, right? And we need to understand and grapple with just how much knowledge we want to have about our friends or how much knowledge we want to have about ourselves, or how much knowledge you want to have about our institutions. I just don't believe in absolute transparency as a cure to all of the world's problems. Very often, if we knew everything about our friends or even about our relatives, a lot of friendships would unravel, right? So we have to grapple with the virtues of imperfection, and I think this is something that we didn't have. We didn't need to do before technology became so ubiquitous and it made our world so plastic. And what I mean by plastic is that, you know, now almost anything can have a sensor. You can buy a cheap sensor and attach it to anything, and then that sensor will report what that object does or how it feels. You can build a sensor into your umbrella, which will check the weather for the day, and it will start flashing and will make a sound that you need to take that umbrella that you when you leave the house because it's about to rain, right? And this is something that was not possible before. Now it is possible because connectivity is everywhere and sensors can be attached to anything, right? So objects become smart, but as they become smart, they pose all sorts of questions of how just their smartness will reflect upon our smartness, whether those smart objects will make us smart, whether they will make us dumb, because things that we previously had to explore and learn and invest some cognitive effort in will just become obvious and we'll take them for granted instead of questioning them, right? So this tension between smartness and dumbness of our devices and of ourselves, I think, is also something that we need to explore with imperfection serving as the background.
The other bias that it creates beyond the bias towards technology is the bias towards a kind of market logic. It's the marketing of everything, the commodification of everything.
There is that element too. I think very often now we are being forced or urged to do things because we can earn virtual points or badges, or we can impress our friends by recycling, for example, properly. And now that our trash bins have become smart, they can actually report our behavior to all of our friends, and that way we can earn points for being environmentally friendly. And I think it is possible to build that logic onto everything, again, because everything is now has a connectivity dimension to it. Everything is connected, and everything has a sensor. But we have to understand that very often such schemes are marketed to us as if they were based on just a normal and obvious and natural extension of human nature. We are being told that it's natural for people to compete, or it's natural for people to play games, or it's natural for people to be playful. So accumulating points for recycling is completely natural. It's like playing football or soccer. Right, that's all part of the game that we humans are playing, and I think we need to be very critical of such claims because very often what we see as what is marketed to us as game is actually nothing other than market logic. It's accumulation of frequent flyer miles, right? You can also think that it's a game, but clearly there is a whole element of consumption there, which needs to be scrutinized. And I have nothing against consumption and consumerism per se, but we also need to understand that when we start relying on market mechanisms and market incentives to do things that we previously did through moral incentives or political incentives, something changes in our relationship to those practices, right? So if I'm being asked to recycle because I will be rewarded points, which I can then convert into buying a latte, that's very different logic, and that's a very different set of demands on me as a citizen than when I was asked to recycle because I was told that recycle is a right thing to do and it would save the environment. Right? What it does to me, this change of logics from political and ethical logic to the market logic, what it does to me as a citizen is something that we also need to discuss. And we don't. So Silicon Valley just markets these tools and strategies to us based on their efficiency. Of course I'll recycle more if I can earn points. But this is not the whole thing, right? There are still important elements of citizenship that need to be discussed. You know, would I be able to do anything that is expected of me as a citizen if most of my interactions in life with the political system or fellow citizens have now been recast as just this extension of market logic? Would I pick up some litter on the street if I'm not rewarded with Facebook points, right? This is the kind of questions we need to be asking. Yes, in some local isolated context, it might improve efficiency. But improving efficiency does not matter in the local context because, you know, we all inhabit lives of many contexts and we all have to do many, many different things and we have to look at it holistically and globally. Optimizing efficiency locally, you know, even if you can do it with technology, is not the only relevant dimension that we need to consider.
It is also made more complicated and in some ways, I guess, more insidious by the invisibility of a lot of this technology, that it is hidden behind so many other things.
Yes, I mean, you know, the technological environment that we inhabit at this point is a lot of it is run on code, and a lot of it is run on algorithms, right? Which we cannot examine. We do not understand how many of the things around us work. We do not understand how many of the smart devices work. We don't understand the logic they rely on. So a lot of it is very obscure. And, you know, I'm not actually advocating that all of us should learn how to code and all of us should learn how to, you know, look inside our smart fridges or smart cars. I think it's actually, okay. We don't know, but we need to start thinking of institutions that can step in and start examining and regulating some of this code-based infrastructures, right? So instead of having everyone learn code in order to understand how Google works, I would rather have regulators step in and start examining or auditing perhaps their search algorithms to make sure that they don't incorporate too many biases of different kinds, right? Again, it's not just a matter, we don't have to become more technologically literate as individual citizens in order to exercise more power and control over the entities that come to mediate and shape our lives, right? This can be done institutionally, and I think it should be done institutionally. So what is needed is more political will on our behalf from citizens to build the right institutions and the right structures to inject a little bit more control and a little bit more accountability. Not necessarily transparency, by the way. I'm not saying that Google should be disclosing the algorithms that it uses, but accountability over those algorithms, I think, is very important, and we need to build the right institutional structures and frameworks in order for that accountability to emerge.
Is this something that needs to be dealt with by policymakers, many of whom don't really understand the full scope or complexity of what they're dealing with, or is it a broader conversation that we need to have in the public sphere first, away from or prior to policymakers getting involved?
I think we need to have a broader conversation in the public sphere, not least because I know of a lot of policymakers who would actually be happy to delegate their own problem-solving responsibilities to Silicon Valley. If Silicon Valley can solve the problem of obesity just by making certain food items disappear from the menu once you wear Google glasses and go into a fast food restaurant, of course politicians would be excited because it means longer need to work on difficult reforms, right? And Google might actually deliver. So I wouldn't necessarily say that politicians should be leading this debate. We should have a broader public debate about just how much efficiency we want to have in the systems, just how much imperfection and opacity and ambiguity we want to preserve. We need to have a debate as to how we can make technology companies more accountable without undermining their business models. I do buy the argument from Google that disclosing the algorithms would undermine the business model, but I do think that we have ways, institutional ways, of still exerting some control over their code through some kind of code audits, right? We have audits of financial blocks. We have audits of financial statements. Many of them are not fully disclosed to the public, but we still have third-party auditors come in, examine, scrutinize, and endorse or not endorse company records. Why we cannot do the same thing for algorithms, right? We wouldn't need to disclose them, but we can still have at least some guarantee that someone responsible or not, as also happens in the case of many auditors, has looked at the books and verified them, right? So I think before it's not a matter of formulating three or four policies that, you know, you can put on the policymaking agenda and push them through. I do think that we are reaching a point with self-driving cars and 3D printers and drones and Google Glasses and all sorts of smart devices where it's time to engage in broader social public debate about how we should live with the smart environments and just how much smartness can we tolerate in our system without ourselves becoming all too dumb.
And finally, the point is of what happens if we don't have this debate, and in fact we keep going down the road that we're on towards this solutionism, and we inhabit this kind of kingdom of the geeks eventually.
And that's my biggest fear, that we will end up in a world where Silicon Valley not only builds all this infrastructure, but it's essentially a place through which our policymakers are trying to solve the problems that have been haunting us for many, many years. And I just don't trust Silicon Valley to do it in a responsible manner, in part because they don't have the democratic accountability that our politicians have, at least in theory. And they just have very, I think, one-dimensional, narrow-minded views about human nature. And without broadening those views, I just don't trust Silicon Valley to be a responsible problem solver, or to describe problems in a way that will be representative of so many different groups and people who may have views different from Silicon Valley. I don't think that if you ask Silicon Valley to define what counts as a problem in the field of copyright, you'll get a very balanced or objective answer, right? I mean, there are many questions where Silicon Valley has issues at stake and interests at stake, and their basic framing of the problem will be very different if the problem was framed by someone else, right? And this is something we need to understand. And unfortunately, everything I hear from politicians, both in the U.S. and in Europe, it revolves around celebrating these companies for how much innovation they have unleashed, which is true. But the fact that they unleashed so much innovation does not necessarily convince me that we can trust them to unleash the kind of political and social innovation that we need to face the problems that have been haunting us for decades. And it's those problems that we need to tackle. And yes, Silicon Valley can play a role in tackling them, but I think it would be very naive and counterproductive to make it the sole problem solver when it comes to those problems.
Evgeny Morozov, his book is To Save Everything, Click Here: The Folly of Technological Solutionism. Evgeny, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it.